Well, it's 12:30. Let's start. I apologize that there's a technical problem, so the images I had planned to show you, I can't show. So I can certainly talk about Will forever, and we'll do it without pictures. I think to make it a little helpful, I'm going to ask Danny Fingeroth, who's in the office, I mean in the audience, to come and join me so we can have a little back and forth. Danny's part of the Will Eisner Week Committee and often coordinates things celebrating Will, especially this centennial year. Danny, you may know as a former editor at Marvel and an author of books about Superman and all kinds of things. So thanks, Danny.
You're welcome.
We'll improvise. We'll talk about Will. I'll just start with a couple of favorite stories I know some of you in the audience probably already know a lot about Will. Some of you may know very little, so we'll kind of try to keep it general. I met Will in a very unexpected way when I was, I think I was 24. I was attending my first convention in New York. Phil Sewing was the impresario. And I was being a fanboy. I had actually probably been a two-year veteran at that point. I started a underground comics company, Kitchen Sink Press, and a French guest, Maurice Horn, who had been writing books about comics early on, he saw my badge and he said, "Oh," in a French voice, "Mr. Kitchen, Mr. Will Eisner, he wants to meet you." And I said, "I'm sure you're mistaken." And he said, no, he said to watch for you. So I followed him to Will's hotel suite. And sure enough, to my astonishment, Will wanted to talk to me about this phenomenon he heard about called Underground Comics. And the reason he was intrigued was we were breaking a lot of the rules. And if you know much about Will at all, you know he was not just an amazing artist and storyteller, but a very astute businessman and an innovator. And Underground Comics were innovating the comics industry in a way that intrigued him. So he started asking me these questions, like, "Is it true you distribute your books on a non-returnable basis?" And I said, "That's right." He was like, "Wow. Is it true the artists retain their copyright?" I said, "They do, sir." I said, "And the artists get to keep original art?" "Yes." So one by one, all these things... Oh, we have a laptop. All right. Well, that'll be helpful. All right, Danny, get lost.
I know.
No, I know.
I've been replaced, not even by a Macintosh.
Thank you.
All right. Well, this will help a little bit. We'll keep Danny up here too. So just to finish that anecdote I started, what was amazing to me at the time, but not in retrospect, is that Will was always a very curious person. And anything about the comics industry that was changing, new, fresh, he wanted to know about it, even from a very young hippie cartoonist. And that was typical of Will. This is a picture of Will. Those of you who maybe met him late in life... Will at one time did have hair. This is him in 1940, writing a script on his typewriter in the Tudor City, a studio in New York. In 1940 is the year the Spirit began. Prior to that, Will had been packaging comics with the Eisner and Iger studio. Packaging means that he was responsible for creating stories for other publishers on a work-for-hire basis. With the Spirit, Will had the opportunity to break out of what he considered a comic book ghetto to do a... probably getting a little ahead of myself. Before that, where he started was a very obscure magazine. Wow, what a magazine. They don't make titles like that anymore. On the cover is a very obscure character he did called Harry Carey, which he actually invented in high school. There's a book out from Locust Moon called The Lost Art of Will Eisner. If you're curious about this particular character and his origins, I suggest you check it out. Also, while he was with the Eisner Niger studio, he created a series called Hawks of the Seas, which is notable mainly because it was his first extended adventure strip that he was doing himself. And in the course of doing that, he kind of discovered that you could have splash pages and you could do things in a very dramatic way that comic books really were not utilizing. It was kind of his playground. And with Will, everything was constantly an experimentation. But he was lured away in late 1939 by one of the smaller syndicates in Des Moines, Iowa, to create a special feature that had not been done before, which is a comic book inserted into newspapers. So it's like if you get your Sunday paper and then like the magazine falls out or an advertising section, back then a comic book could fall out. And it was 16 pages. The first 7 or 8 pages were the spirit. And what's also remarkable, besides the format being so innovative, is Will, who was at that point all of 22 years old, 23 maybe, he insisted on ownership, which was unheard of. The syndicates in those days owned everything. They still generally do today. But he was able to leverage his power, which was that he was reliable and he was good and they had faith he could do this. And he was able to acquire the copyright to this. In those days in the 1940s, you could count on your fingers how many cartoonists owned their strip and have fingers left. It was him, Al Capp, Milton Caniff.
That's the very first spirit.
That's the very first one in June of 1940. Went on, there were 600 and some of these, lasted 12 years. So except for when he was in the Army, Will was responsible every single day. He had to write a pencil, ink, a page. And, of course, he had assistants at different stages, but still, it was a daunting task. As Will told me one time, I didn't have a girlfriend in those days. This is an example of, this is an original, one of the very few that survived from those days, to show you how innovative his layouts were. The spirit is way in the bottom holding a lantern. But what you really get is this view from this mysterious shaft. This is a haunted house story. So you get to see the spider web and the opening door, and it's pulling you in literally into the story. And that's one of the things Will was great at. One of the other, a few surviving... Oops, come on, Arrow. There we go. This is the oldest surviving splash page. The girl getting spanked is Ellen Dolan, his long-running, long-suffering girlfriend, who was the daughter of Commissioner Dolan, who was the only other person who knew the spirit's alter ego. Denny Colt was a detective who was thought to be killed by the Cobra, Dr. Cobra, but in reality, he was just in suspended animation. So the whole premise of the spirit was this wispy mask, just like Superman. If you put on glasses, no one will recognize you. So
I'm trying to figure out the narrative.
Yeah.
You know? I'm trying to figure out what led to that.
Right.
That actual scene.
There's another great one, heroic pose. This one is, I think... oh, I forget the name of it, but I love the trench coat and the what I also love about this, one of Will's many talents as an inker, if you look in the folds of the clothing and the little parallel brush strokes, that's called feathering, and all of this is done with a sable hair brush, and the brush is a hard instrument to control and to make do magic. But when you're a master of it like Will, you can go quite fast, and those parallel lines of feathering, he could just move his hand as fast as you could imagine, and these beautiful things would emerge. Will was a natural artist, and he kind of took it for granted. And I remember many times people would compliment him on his drawing, especially fans in line to get an autograph. But what he really liked getting complimented for was his writing. He thought that was the hard part. He thought anybody could draw. It's another great example. This is Peugeot, one of the femme fatales with an impossibly thin waist. I think it's 11-inch waistline, I think. She was named after the red light district in Paris. And one of the many nemesises that followed the spirit through the years, more often than not, these femme fatales would fall in love with the spirit and complicate things. Generally, it was unreciprocated. It's another example of a classic splash page where the spirit's in the background and he brings you right up face front with a gutter. And this one is called A River of Crime. And if you can read, there's a great... can you read that, Danny? Is it too small? It's just a great intro to the story.
Crime is a man-made street.
Yeah. So again, what you see on here, the logo you see is floating down the water into the gutter. And one of the things Will was, of course, also famous for was changing the title logo every single time. Most strips, think of any other famous strip, Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, all of them have a standard logo. That's a trademark. The spirit had an ever-changing logo because it was one of Will's ways of just staying inventive and not falling into a predictable pattern. The other thing about this is it shows his lifelong obsession with water in this strip. There's a disproportionate amount of rain and gutters and dock scenes and thunderstorms, you name it. They were so prevalent that his friend Harvey Kurtzman at one time coined the term Eisenspritz, which is a good Yiddish-sounding word, and it is now, I hope, entering the comics lexicon. So anytime you see a strip with a lot of water in, you can knowingly say, nice Eisenspritz. Yeah. So another favorite example of how Will would use, in this case, the panels go in the following sequence, left to right, middle panel, and so on, but collectively, they're the rooms of a house. So he had to write this script so that the dialogue would logically follow in the normal pattern, but in each case, somebody in a different room is talking. So Will didn't take shortcuts. This was well thought out. And remember, he had to do one of these every single day. For 12 years, he was responsible. It's another example of the logo being part of the cityscape. I'm showing this because it's an article that appeared in the Philadelphia Bulletin in 1941 when the spirit was just getting underway. Will was still in his mid-20s. And he said some absolutely remarkable things in here. And I pulled an excerpt because in the context of 1941, no one, literally no one, was talking like this. This is like you might expect maybe Art Spiegelman in 1988, but this is Will in 1941. The comic strip, he explains, is no longer a comic strip, but in reality an illustrated novel. It is new and raw in form just now, but material for limitless intelligent development. And eventually and inevitably, it will be a legitimate medium for the best of writers and artists. It is already the embryo, Eisner apologizes a little for the trite phrase, of a new art form, and he believes in it and will stay with it proudly and without apologies. Isn't that pretty remarkable for that era?
That's pretty. Every other artist in those days would have said he will stay with it until he's able to move on to legitimate illustration.
Yeah.
He was the first and only guy to...
Yeah, he did. He was one of the early members of the National Cartoonist Society, and he said when he talked like this, they would scoff at him. People like Rube Goldberg would say, young man, we're just here to sell newspapers. And Will would say, no, it's going to be a literary form. It's going to be respected. And they would laugh at him. This is a nice self-portrait Will did in 1975 when he was smoking a pipe. He joked that when he started out, he looked like the spirit, and he ended up looking like Commissioner Dolan. And here we have, this is the Spirit doing a portrait of Will, which I enjoyed. And when World War II broke out, Will entered the Army, became a warrant officer, and was stationed in good part at the Pentagon. And when they saw the kind of talent he had, they utilized him immediately to do manuals for Army on proper maintenance. It was originally called Army Motors. This is a later version called PS. And when they first talked about this, the general who was in charge of the technical manuals scoffed at the idea that comic books could be used to teach soldiers anything. And so one of the officers who believed in Will said, let's do a test. So the University of Chicago tested one group of soldiers with Will's comic book manuals and another with the old kind of boring, kind of manuals. And the comic books apparently won handily. So the general who was scoffing said, whatever works. And so that opened the door for comics to become an educational tool, and they've been used ever since in the U.S. Army, and that was Will's innovation. Will also did comic books. When the Spirit ended in 1952, starting a little earlier, this one's around 1950, he did educational comics for private industry and also other governments beyond the Army. This is for the Job Corps, where you would the government was trying to educate young workers on different professions that you could get into. And so millions of these things were printed and given out in dozens of variations. In 1966, after the Spirit had been retired for about 14 years, Harvey Comics convinced Will to reprint. This is where I and a lot of my generation rediscovered, or I should say discovered the Spirit, because I was too young to read it when it first came out. But this was a really important book that opened up a lot of eyes at a point when comics were just starting to break out again. And Will did new covers for it. And this is him during that time in the mid-60s. So getting back to my original story that I was telling you when I first met Will in 1971, that's us. I'm the one on the left. And it's only slightly exaggerated. I had lots of hair and a scraggly beard, and I had, you know, scruffy bell bottoms, and Will was in a three-piece suit. And as he noted, oftentimes many years later, he said, Dennis and I both smoke pipes, but with different substances. But early on, because Will was interested in what was going on with the undergrounds, and he loved the new business model. For him, it was both about the aesthetics, and he liked, as a creator, the new business model that would allow him to retain not only ownership, but a great deal of control over it. And one of the first things he did was a guest cover for one of my underground comics called Snarf. So the Spirit is with Commissioner Dolan breaking into the headquarters of my studio. And to him, underground meant we were literally working in a sewer. Remember the Eisenspritz part. And of course, nothing was sacred. So he doesn't portray us in a very flattering way. You notice the hippie on the left says, how do you spell defecate? And guy at the bottom, after crumb, what is there left to say? And then Will continued to do initially a series of reprints with me. This is an example of an early wraparound cover. And he's starting to loosen up, and because of the audience is an adult audience and there's no restraint, he starts to get a little more risque. You see on the back cover, he's got someone is hiding heroin inside a false breast. And Otherwise, it's Will as usual. He's just taking advantage of the new freedom.
As one does.
The witch?
As one does.
Yes, exactly. Here's another great Eisenspritz cover, one of my favorites. But the big thing then was in 1978, Will shook up the industry again by coming out with A Contract with God, which was, for context again, remember, everything was comic books. There was no such thing as a graphic novel. This came out, it had a square binding like a real book. It wasn't printed in black or white, it wasn't in color, it had sepia ink. And it was four stories, partly autobiographical, but mostly about life in New York during the Depression era. And it was pretty stark, bleak stories. And when it came out, it just was an eye-opener. I can't tell you how dramatic it was for those of us in the industry. And we suddenly went, wow, we don't have to make pamphlets anymore. We can make books. There is no limit. And the page count doesn't have to be restricted to, you know, 32 pages or whatever. It can be as long as you need to tell a story. So Will inspired every thinking professional when this came out in 1978. And not long after this, you saw Mouse and Watchmen and Dark Knight. All these things followed. He also called it a graphic novel, which technically he didn't invent. Technically, Richard Kyle came up with that term for a fanzine, but Will was the first to popularize it. And now, for better or worse, that is what we call them, even though many of these are not novels. Novel implies fiction. And so some people, graphic implies sexy. But it's the term that's caught on. Will also liked the term sequential narrative. That one did not catch on. One of the things that Will liked about the undergrounds too was there was a lot of autobiographical material. This was Will's first overtly autobiographical story, The Dreamer, which tells the very beginning of his career, how he became a cartoonist, how he started his studio, and he's got little capsule pieces about Jack King and Lou Fine and Bob Powell, all the other greats who worked in his studio. The most overtly autobiographical one, though, is To the Heart of the Storm, which is basically a history of his family and his own experiences with anti-Semitism going back to Europe when his parents emigrated. It's a really, to me, one of my favorites of Will's. If you are looking to discover Will, this is one I would recommend among three or four that are really exceptional. To end it, I just want to show a few pages from this, and then Danny and I will talk. One of the things about comic books that for many, many years was standard was just a panel after panel after panel with a line around it. Will destroyed that notion many years earlier, but as he got older, he became more and more inventive with the progression from panel to panel. So here you see, this could be three panels with, you know, oblongs and lines around them, but he integrates them in a way that is not standard. And then the next one, the same. Here you have the black background, but one merges into another, and you have a close-up of these guys, and then interrupted by a panel, and he's playing. Here you have, again, with perspective. You get a bird's-eye view. You're up above these guys, and then a little further away, and then you come back. And even on the lower left, you see it at an angle. Will grew up with his father being a designer for the Yiddish theater, and so you see, basically, many times with Will, it's a theatrical setting. You almost feel you're sitting in the audience with Will, and he's manipulating these images in unpredictable ways. And I just wanted to show some of these because each one of these is a thing of beauty in itself, and he does it page after page.
He's also very aware and conscious in the use of the word balloons and the letters.
Absolutely.
There's much part of the design as the figures.
And it, for the reader, it makes it a more seamless read. To me, a lot of comics, even ones that are good and recommended, they can be kind of tedious and, I don't know, the visuals can just get a little bit boring. With Will, the visuals are never boring. He's constantly changing. It's another, this is talking about his father who emigrated from Vienna. A little story about him as a struggling artist. And again, you never see, or I should say seldom see with Will, just a panel progression. You see images merging together. And your eye understands these are three separate sequences, but none of them are constructed quite the same way. So I just wanted to show some of these because it's easy to take for granted that this is a rote thing and artists just sit down and they bang these things out. No, Will planned the page as well as he planned the story and the individual compositions. Each one of these things, even at the bottom where you have the fade, this is him, again, reminiscing. This is the beginning of the spirit, where he's meeting with an executive from the syndicate and deciding he's going to leave the comic book industry and get into the syndicate business. So we can basically stop here and move on. I just want to end here. This later in Will's life, he began dealing more with the Jewish themes. And here you have the life force was serialized here in Will Eisner's Quarterly. And it's a famous sequence here, a soliloquy of Jacob Starka, the main character, talking to a cockroach. Jacob has just suffered a heart attack, and he sees a cockroach on his back struggling to live. And he engages in a conversation with the cockroach until he's strong enough to get up and leave, and the cockroach flips over and walks away too. And it's a great sequence, 10 or 12 pages. To me, it's a classic. It's like the Hamlet of comics. The very last thing Will did, it's probably his most didactic work, was the plot, the secret story of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, the hoax about you know, Jews allegedly plotting to take over the world, which was concocted by the Tsar's secret police in the 1890s, but still unfortunately believed today in parts of the world. And so Will took it upon himself to expose that in a graphic novel form, and that was published posthumously. If you want to know more about Will, too, I'd recommend my friend Michael Schumacher's biography that came out from Bloomsbury a few years ago. And with that, Danny, let's talk a bit, and then let's open it up to some questions.
So my question is, why you, of all the underground cartoonists, of all the mainstream cartoonists, why did Will sort you out, and why do you think you guys hit it off? What did you have in common?
Well, obviously we didn't look anything alike, and there was a generational difference. I think what did it with us was a shared passion for the medium, and also I was one of those rare cartoonists who had a knack for business and appreciated the business side. So as soon as Will started talking about business models, I suddenly got why he was interested in undergrounds, and I realized he had grown up in a time when there was no ability to do what I did. I was part of that generation that was identified by, in simple terms, the anti-Vietnam War movement, and it's the fact that hippies were rebelling against a lot of things, and everything from the, you know, music, fashion, anything in the culture, kind of, there was a generational divide, and comic books were my passion, and my generation of cartoonists saw the opportunity to not work for Marvel or DC and not have to give up ownership of our strips, and we wanted to talk about real things, not necessarily fantasy things. And I think those generally paralleled Will's way of thinking. And he had always been breaking the rules, but he was in a system where the publishers had all the power. And suddenly he saw we could essentially self-publish. I was a cartoonist and a publisher, and he had been too for a while. So it was an unlikely alliance, I guess, but beginning in that first meeting, we never stopped working together for, I think, 35 years.
Well, somebody pointed out, I don't know if it was you, but somebody pointed out that since he did go to the Spirit in 1940, he really hadn't been in the system in the way that so many other comic artists were since 1940. I mean, he had managed to kind of avoid, I think he did some stuff, the Spirit would be reprinted occasionally, but he really, early on, saw, I think, the traps and the dangers of, you know, exchanging ownership in what you've done for actual upfront money.
Right.
You have a story where I think you were saying, when at that convention where you mentioned you saw some of S. Clay Wilson's work, but that didn't scare him off.
That's true. Well, after Will and I had talked in his room for quite a while about undergrounds in the abstract, he confessed he had never seen one. And he said, may I see, you know, examples of what you're doing? So I said, sure. So we went down on the convention floor where Phil Suling had several tables in a row with virtually every underground. And I was about to judiciously pick one when Will impulsively grabbed Zap number 2 and unfortunately opened it up to a page by S. Clay Wilson that involved, I'll just say, a pirate who had cut off the member of another pirate, had it on the tip of a fork, and he said, "The head tastes best." And Will looked at that, and he literally blanched, and suddenly the generational difference came to the surface, and he said, "I had no idea these were this graphic," and I tried to explain that was not necessarily typical. But by then, the conversation had pretty much ended. But fortunately, I had his business card in my pocket, and I followed up with a package of comics I knew he would appreciate. And so what it pointed out to him is that when you have a situation with no censorship, you can have extremes. And some of the artists took advantage. Robert Crumb and S. Clay Wilson were notorious for outrageous images. But there were plenty of other artists who had the same freedom and chose to use it in different ways. And Will realized, you know, that was a natural thing. When my generation hated the Comic Code Authority so much that when we had the chance to break that wall, we wanted to stomp on it and crush it because it was such a hated symbol. So now, you know, the Comic Code Authority is gone. It's a different world, but you have to put it in the context of the times.
What do you think made it possible? Comic cartoonists of every generation, but certainly that generation, they learn 4 or 5 tricks and they learn how to do really well, and they just keep doing it over and over and over, and they, you know, you can make it looking that way. What do you think it was about Will that rejected that, that made him curious?
I think he was always ambitious, you know, from a very early age, from what I can tell. He was always very entrepreneurial. Even starting out when he was a newsboy, helping to raise money for his family, he said he had to scrap for the best corner. He was selling newspapers in the Wall Street district, and he said the toughest kid got the best corner. And the best corner was more newspapers sold. More newspapers sold, the more money you made. And I think that's one of the earliest lessons he learned. I think he was ambitious, and he would learn the rules. He told me at one point that the biggest, toughest kids who got the best corner, they ended up the ones who owned the newsstand in the corner. And it ended up being a mob business. And he said it was no coincidence that the mob got into that business because they were dealing with tough kids who turned into tough guys who...
In an all-cash business.
In an all-cash business.
Shall we take some questions from folks?
Yeah, there's a microphone too if it's helpful, but we can probably hear you.
This is also in the centennial of Jack Kirby, and I was wondering if you could compare and contrast Jack Kirby and the life.
Well, you know, Jack, as a very young artist, worked in Will's studio when his name was Jack Kurtzberg, and Will had a certainly a knack even early on for recognizing talent. So Jack was one of many that turned out to be greats.
I love that there's that tape of the two of them conversation.
Well,
where Jack says, or one of them says, really, you must be 10 years older than Jack. And of course, they were 6 months apart in age.
Right.
They seemed to love to perpetuate the myth that Will was...
Seemed older. Yeah, I'm reminded, speaking of the mob, there was when Will had his studio and Jack was in the studio too, they had a towel service, and a mob character came into his studio and said, hey, you got to start using our towel service, get rid of, Joe or whatever. And he was being very aggressive, and Will wasn't quite sure how to deal with him. And Jack suddenly stood up. Jack was a very tough guy, and he knew that Will was too nice to deal with the situation. And he came in, he said, Will, should I get rid of this guy? And pushed him out. He was the muscle in the studio. And I think that's kind of typical of it too. You know, when Will was in the army, they put him to use making educational comics. Jack was in the infantry. Jack saw action, I think. And
well, Jack, when they sent Jack ahead to draw maps of the enemy.
That's right.
So
that's right.
They actually sent him into danger alone.
Right. So he was a legitimately tough guy. But one thing I noticed, because I've heard people say, oh, didn't Will run a sweatshop back in those days? Well, it all depends on how you define the term. But all I can tell you is years later, whenever I would see those two at a convention, it would be like they would run toward each other and hug and embrace like brothers. They loved each other.
Did you know Kirby? So, I'm not sure.
I did not know Kirby well, no, just superficially. But I could tell they loved each other. And there was a great mutual respect.
Yesterday, you spoke about, you made kind of sort of light of it in the relationship that you have here. And did you actually, have a relationship, and did you learn things that helped you in business? And could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, he's referring to a panel I had yesterday about the 50th anniversary of Underground Comics, and I showed a strip I did that tongue-in-cheek showed me and Hef partying together. Relationship's too strong a term, but I did have the pleasure of spending four or five times at the Playboy Mansion, thanks to Harvey Kurtzman, another genius that I was privileged to work with, because Harvey did Little Annie Fanny, and earlier than that, Trump Magazine, which, by the way, was collected recently in a book by the Kitchen Sink Books imprint of Dark Horse, but not to digress, Hefner loved comics. And
Hefner wanted to be a cartoonist.
Yeah, I think, next to women, he liked comics best. And so he was very supportive of a lot of artists over the years, not just the gag cartoonist, but, when Harvey created Mad, it was about the same time Hefner started Playboy, and they were admiring each other's publications. They were both revolutionary publications for the early 50s, and in this post-war generation of males, I think the concept of Playboy was a pretty wild and crazy idea, and likewise was Mad, an anti-establishment satire publication like we'd never seen before. So there was a mutual admiration society, and Hefner had actually contacted Will Eisner at the time, and Will didn't want to have anything to do with a girly magazine, but Harvey was more than happy to work with him.
Didn't Stan Lee offer Will the chance to be editor-in-chief of Marvel one point?
Right. Yeah, I remember Will called me up right after that, and he said, I had the chance to take over Marvel. He said, what should we do with it? And I was like, it's not a question I knew how to deal with. I said, are you seriously thinking about it, Will? And he said, nah, but he said it might be fun to go and shake things up. but he ultimately said no. But the reason Stan offered it to him was, again, because he knew Will had both the creative ability and he could run a publishing company. But I don't think he ever took it seriously.
Any other questions? No. That's just the more questions. Yes.
Just a comment. It's really interesting. Right. As well as some of the narration, narrative text, narrative text, but it's just beautiful written. Lyrical response.
Can you repeat the question, Dan?
I think it was a comment that Will wrote as beautifully as he drew. Well, I interviewed him a couple of years before he died, and I asked him, you know, you consider yourself more of a writer or an artist, and his answer was that he writes with pictures and words. He didn't see any distinction between the two. I think that is true.
I think as much as anyone, the Will's pictures tell the story, but
also his writing was
One little anecdote to me summed it up. I was at a convention, I think, in Chicago, and Will was there doing a signing. There was a long line, and people would come up, and, you know, you'd have a half a minute to say something while Will was personalizing a book, and almost everyone would say, "Oh, Mr. Eisner, I love your art. Mr. Eisner, I love your art. Mr. Eisner, I love your art." And he'd say, "Thank you, thank you." And then somebody came up to him and said, "Mr. Eisner, I love your writing." And he looked up, and he smiled, and he talked to this person for 5 minutes, because that to him was the ultimate compliment. Like I said earlier when I was showing some of the images, Will took drawing for granted. It was so easy for him. He just thought anybody could learn how to do it, but writing was the real skill. And of course, with comics, you have to be, ideally, really good at both if you're going to be an auteur like he was.
I just wanted to say thank you guys for, you know, publishing for new generations the Eisner work that came out. And Telegus, probably the honor of, I'm a comic book maker, my name is Mick Gray, the honor of my career has been in 2001, I got an Eisner Award with the group from Prometheus, Alan Moore, J. Williams, and Mika. And I did not know what was going to happen, but when I went up on stage, I got to receive my Eisner from Eisner.
Right.
Will Eisner handed me the Eisner and shook his hand. And that moment will never, ever, you know, go away. Like I said, I'm getting chills right now thinking that I did that. This man, we know, you know, what you know, what everybody should know, was an innovator of innovators. He did things that nobody else did, and he set the pace for all of us, you know, that are doing comics today. And it's, you know, I just want to say thank you and tell you that little anecdote of mine.
No, that
the moment of my life.
It was some of it.
You know, those of us who, you know, grew up loving Will and, you know, professionally are involved with Will's legacy. How do we keep his legacy alive? How do we make young people aware and appreciative and try it?
To me, I think it starts in part with retailers who, when I go into a good bookstore, I know I can find Mark Twain, Hemingway, Shakespeare. If they don't carry those classics, they're not much of a bookstore. I think any good comic book shop worth its salt, and any good bookstore in general, ought to have the classic graphic novels on their shelf too. So any generation, anybody of any age, discovering graphic novels can find Will's classic work. I think as long as it's available, and right now virtually everything is still in print from W.W. Norton and Company and Dark Horse, and you should be able to find them. Will did about 20 graphic novels in the last phase of his life. They all should be available online or in a good store. The spirits have been collected by DC. Almost everything has been collected. And I would just encourage you to start reading them. And I think once you read one or two, you want to read them all. And that's the way to keep it alive.
Thank you. Well, Dennis,
we're given
I
this... Stop.
Sorry. Did you finish?
Oh. Dennis and I will be on panel tomorrow at 11, along with Justin and Jasmine. I'll be lucky about Will Eisner and the Spirit. So tomorrow 11, check it out. Thank you, Dennis. Thank you for inviting me.